From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for the New Statesman, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Joe Biden has won again. By that, we mean that on Monday, December 14th, the members of the Electoral College met in all 50 states here in Washington, D.C., and the vote, as expected, perfectly reflected the results of the nationwide election on November 3rd. President Donald Trump was defeated and will have to leave office next month, but we'll talk about continuing controversy over that. Some Trump officials have been leaving government service, among them the Attorney General William Barr. He had a falling out with the president, but Barr's resignation letter was full of praise for Mr. Trump. We'll talk about that. And we're sorry to say the coronavirus crisis continues all around the world. In many countries, including here in the United States, it's worse than ever. Even as vaccines were developed amazingly quickly, and the jabs or inoculation shots have begun. Let's turn to Tom DeFrank first on U.S. politics. In the Electoral College, where each state is winner take all, here's how it added up. Joe Biden got 306, Donald Trump 232. So now some senior Republicans are admitting that their candidate, President Trump, was defeated. But he is not conceding defeat. And Tom, President Trump probably never will admit that he lost.
I think that's right, Dan. I do not believe the C word, as in concession, is in his dictionary. I just don't think he can do it. His whole personality is about winning. He hates losers. He loves winners. Remember when he was campaigning, he said 4 years ago that we're going to be winning so much, you, the country, will be sick of how much winning we're going to do. So the notion that he would ever kind of graciously admit that he lost and move on is fairly far-fetched. It's not even clear at this point whether he will attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th, which if he does not, would be a real breach of democratic protocol, at least in our democratic system. So I don't think he'll ever concede. I don't think he's going to invite Biden to the White House. I just don't think he's made to do that. And I think it's probably not a smart thing for the president, short term or long term. And we'll just see how it plays out. But Joe Biden is the next president. And at this point, there should be no doubt about that.
Well, at 12 o'clock noon here in Washington on January 20th, Joe Biden officially becomes president. He will be sworn in. That is planned for the usual site on Capitol Hill at the Capitol building. The parades and other celebrations will be scaled back because of the coronavirus. But Emily Tamkin, should anyone have any concern that the Trump family, led by the president, of course, might not leave the White House?
There was a report that said that idea was floated at one point within Trump's circle in the White House and that he was talked out of it. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility. I think more likely is that he does leave at some point and continues to claim that the results are wrong and that actually he won, and perhaps hold a rally on Inauguration Day, something to try to keep the focus on him that will be less obviously humiliating to him than being dragged out of the White House on January 20th.
Well, there's still a very big political fight in the state of Georgia. It's very unusual. Both seats in the U.S. Senate are up for grabs in a special election, and folks there have through January 5th to vote. If Democrats win both those seats, Democrats, meaning the new president Joe Biden, will control the U.S. Senate, though just barely. Now, the Republicans hold both of those seats. The incumbents, the current senators, seem favored to win, Tom DeFrank. It would be very surprising if the Democrats could capture both those seats.
Very surprising, Dan. Very surprising, but it is not beyond the realm of possibility. And it's interesting, we'll talk about this later, probably about stimulus programs and the state of the economy, but But Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who has been holding back on bringing an economic relief aid package to the floor of the Senate, has changed his tune. And the reason he's giving Republicans is that our two senators, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, are getting, quote, hammered on the issue of no stimulus legislation for millions of people around the country who are in need, but especially in Georgia. So that's a wild card, but I agree. Conventionally speaking, I'd be surprised if the Democrats pick up both of those seats. If they pick up one, that's not enough to control the Senate. They have to pick up both.
Let's look at any long-term changes here in U.S. politics. Emily, you write for a British-based publication, The New Statesman, readers all around the world, and they're trying to figure out the United States. Have you been suggesting that the usual battle lines between Democrats and Republicans have been changed, perhaps forever, by the 4 years of Donald Trump?
I think that battle lines between the parties, that is, who holds what view on any given issue, I think that those are always changing. And one party will support X and the other Y, and then 8 years later it will reverse. But what I have been suggesting, and actually just saying, is that I do think that politics in this country has been changed by the last 4 years. I think that Donald Trump's party, in a way, I think that there are many people who are now modeling themselves off of him coming up in the Republican Party. And the Democratic Party has changed too. You know, Biden is obviously the most powerful person in the Democratic Party and will soon be the most powerful person in the country. But there is a huge chunk of the party that doesn't see eye to eye with him, and further, that doesn't want to go back to politics as usual either. So this is a long-winded way of saying that less than policy changes or battle lines, I think that our very understanding of politics and power in this country has shifted.
Our very understanding of politics. I mean, still, we have a democracy where the members of Congress are elected by the various districts and states around the country. The president, of course, is elected, though now we have disputes over that. And there's that third branch of government, the judiciary, where President Trump was lucky, you might say, that three vacancies developed on the Supreme Court, and he was able to fill those. Absolutely a long-term change. Tom DeFrank, when we think about the 4 years of Donald Trump, I mean, he was very unconventional and different. Do you think it has an eternal impact?
Eternal is a long time, Dan, but I think it's fair to say that his reshaping of the federal courts, and especially the Supreme Court, will have a very long-lasting impact. The three conservative judges on the Supreme Court now means there are twice as many conservative justices on that court than there are liberals, and that's going to take a generation to change. So that, I think, is a very long-lasting, but it won't be eternal. With every Supreme Court justice who retires or dies, steps down for medical reasons, whatever, the balance will change as long as Joe Biden is president, and it depends on your political point of view. For better or worse, that will probably be Trump's lasting achievement. The other problem is the polarization, the lack of bipartisanship over the last 4 years is going to take a while to get fixed as well. But the Supreme Court and his federal judicial appointments will be the most long-lasting legacy of the Trump years.
At least two of the challenges filed by President Trump supporters challenging the vote counts in some of the states in the November election, at least two of those challenges did get filed at the Supreme Court, meaning the justices could consider them, but to slightly oversimplify, the justices, including the three that President Trump had put in place, rejected those appeals from the Trump side. It's reported from the White House that the president was surprised that even his three appointees to the Supreme Court did not take his side. And then we look at the score, you might say, how many votes were cast in the United States. Very high voter turnout. President Trump is proud to say he got 74 million votes, more than any candidate in the past. But what Mr. Trump doesn't mention is that his challenger, former Vice President Biden, got 81 million votes, 7 million more than Mr. Trump got. So, Emily, considering that rate of participation and the passions, I guess the passion for politics that exists in this country, do you think Joe Biden probably wants to calm everything down, that that's one of his goals?
Oh, absolutely. And I think part of the promise of his campaign was, you know, that America is back. But I think our crises, both foreign and domestic, are going to prove difficult or are going to make it difficult for him to do that. Do I think that he will send out fewer tweets and certainly less and have less inflammatory language? Yes. Do I think that he will put forth policies that are in his mind intended to unite the nation? I do. There are millions of people who do not believe that he's the legitimate president. There are other millions of people who think, I don't want to go back to normal at all. Normal wasn't good for me. We are still in a pandemic. We're in an economic crisis. I think it's going to be very difficult to tell people it's okay, just be calm.
Just be calm. Well, that's a watchword for Washington, D.C. as we head into the big transition on January 20th. By the way, it was noticed that on the same day that the members of the Electoral College confirmed Joe Biden's victory, within minutes, we heard from the White House that Attorney General William Barr is resigning. He'll be leaving the administration. Barr had that job as Attorney General 30 years ago. He came back to be head of the Department of Justice 2 years ago, and Barr seemed to be a very loyal supporter of President Trump. But lately, the president went sour on Bill Barr. Tom, how do you explain everything that happened with the Attorney General?
Dan, I think it's real simple. If you're not toeing the line with Trump on everything, you're no good. And basically, it's true. Barr has been extremely loyal and extremely supportive of just about everything President Trump has wanted him to do. There's a long list, but I think at the end of the day, a few weeks ago, Barr said, we've examined the question of voter fraud and voter irregularities, and we don't find any. That's a paraphrase. And the reporting out of the White House is that Trump just went ballistic. I mean, here's the president still saying, this election was stolen from me, it was rigged, and Barr is on the record saying the Justice Department found no evidence of anything like that. And that's more than enough to put Trump into an uproar. And that, I think, was the end for Barr. The real question was, once that happened, the question was Trump going to fire him, or was there going to be a way to work it out so that Trump would not fire him, but he could leave? There were intermediaries here working on behalf of both parties, but in the end, the chief lawyer at the White House brokered a deal where Barr would come in and drop off a letter of resignation, which was 2 pages long, and almost all of those 2 pages were super supportive of Trump. You would think Trump was Trump was Mother Teresa, Mahatma Gandhi, and a few other people. It was so fulsome in its praise of Trump, and I think that was how it happened. He soured on Barr. He wanted to fire him. Trump was talked out of firing him, so they had what I would call a shotgun divorce that apparently, at least on the surface, was all hugs and kisses, but Trump is still angry at Barr.
We also will discuss reports from U.S. government officials here that several agencies have been hacked. The hackers are alleged to be working for Russia. And of course, the latest on the coronavirus after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for the New Statesman. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. And our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
As President-elect Joe Biden forms his cabinet, almost all the people will require confirmation by the U.S. Senate. We see an effort to represent this country, not so many white men, to be frank. And Pete Buttigieg, he is a white man, a Democrat who ran for his party's presidential nomination. If he does become Secretary of Transportation, if the Senate agrees, then this former mayor from Indiana, Buttigieg, he would be the first openly gay person to be confirmed by the Senate for a cabinet post. Emily, when we think about Buttigieg, some of the other selections, the choices that Biden is making, they seem significant.
Yes, they are significant. They are historic. I think on transportation in particular, there's a frustration from some in the country that domestic cabinet positions or transportation, for example, or housing and development for another, that they become political rewards instead of going to people who really know about housing or transportation. But Buttigieg, you know, had a good record on urban development in South Bend, so we'll see how this goes for him. On the issue of representation, I would just say that I think what many people will be looking for is what these historic and significant picks do, what kind of policies they enact, or rather how they act to change and shape policy for a more diverse country, right? So that it's not just the cabinet that's diverse, but policies serving a diverse America.
Of course, keep in mind that Joe Biden's vice president will be Kamala Harris, who's been a senator representing California. For the first time, a vice president of the United States who is a person of color. Her father, a black immigrant from Jamaica. Her mother was an immigrant from India. Now, Tom DeFrank, such things do make a difference when a new administration wants to connect with the broad variety of people who make up the American society.
Well, that's true up to a point, Dan, but we can't forget that I still think there's about 35% to 40% of the country who are still passionately devoted to Donald Trump. And I would say at least a third of those think the election was stolen from him. So it's going to be hard to reach what I would call the hardcore of Trump's hardcore. But I mean, there's no question that the cabinet that Biden is putting together, assuming they all or most of them get confirmed, is a more diverse cabinet than Trump had, and it's a good start on diversity and reaching out. On Buttigieg, I think it will be interesting to see how he can succeed in what one of the main purposes of Transportation Department is, and that's infrastructure. Everybody knows that roads and highways and ports and airports are crumbling. They're in bad shape, and we need tens of billions of dollars. Some would say a couple of trillion dollars on infrastructure fixes. We in the country are running massive deficits because of the economic decline and the pandemic. And that's going to be Buttigieg's greatest challenge, to see if he can help Biden figure out a way to get some important infrastructure projects done through a very divided Congress.
Let's turn to another subject, high-level hacking. Officials here in Washington say computer systems at the Pentagon, that's the Defense Department, the Treasury, and the Department of Homeland Security were penetrated by hackers believed to be Russians. Russia denies that allegation. Emily, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, Russia has not accepted many allegations. The system that we used to prevent these kinds of attacks was called Einstein. And perhaps this is a lesson in not tempting fate. You know, the New York Times is calling this the greatest intelligence failure in recent history, both because the hackers designed it to evade Einstein's attention and because the U.S. intelligence community, in fairness, was focused on protecting the election. This has been going on since the spring. It was only recently detected. And we don't know yet, I don't think, what the consequences of this hack are.
Now, unfortunately, we've got to discuss the COVID-19 pandemic. In many countries, this second wave, and some places are calling it a third wave, is worse than things were this past spring and then in summer. Just one example, South Africa. Officials say holiday parties have meant that folks are getting together indoors, many not wearing masks or keeping their distance from each other, as though they're waiting for the new vaccines to take care of everything. But until enough people can get the shot, the numbers of hospitalizations and deaths keep climbing. That's the story almost everywhere on this planet. Tom, it was heartwarming, emotional a few days ago to watch the first nurses and doctors in America get the vaccine made by Pfizer and BioNTech. A follow-up dose has to happen 3 or 4 weeks later. All this TV coverage, folks getting their shots. Tom, it's like finally having a weapon to fight back in this war.
It seems, Dan, it feels like this is the beginning of the end, but it's only the beginning. And experts, scientific experts, are saying, don't get cocky, don't let up on precautions, because we're still talking a minimum of 6 to 9 months, or maybe even all of next year, before everyone in the U.S. who needs the vaccine will have the vaccine. This is good news. It's very good news. It's, as I said, the beginning of the end, hopefully, but there's still a question whether there's going to be how quickly enough of these doses reach the average person. Obviously, the priority is going to be healthcare workers, first responders, critically ill people or elderly people in nursing homes, and then you've got to go to people who are over 65 with the medical conditions that make them very vulnerable, like heart problems, diabetes, other things. And that's going to take a while. But I think by the end of February, the situation will be better. But on the other hand, the daily death rate in this country is now over 3,000 a day, every day. This is more than it was at the height of the pandemic in March. And we're not that far away from a huge amount of holiday traveling over Christmas. And it's pretty clear now that the tens of millions of Americans who traveled over the Thanksgiving holiday at the end of November were creating a super spreader event, and we're probably on the verge of another one of those.
Tom, as we headed into the weekend, official figures showed more than 1,650,000 people around the world have died from COVID-19. The United States has the highest death toll, more than 308,000 people dead, more than 100,000 being treated in hospitals right now. And the hospitals are overwhelmed by all this work. Now, when President-elect Joe Biden announced that he would get the vaccine shot in public on TV, President Trump didn't make clear right away what he would do. Don't forget that he was ill briefly with COVID-19. So Mr. Trump has said that he has immunity now. He did say this. He wants to be sure that Biden is not given credit for defeating the virus. Opponents of Trump insist that he did a terrible job with a lack of organized leadership in fighting coronavirus. But the White House says the president pushed health companies and researchers to do their work in so-called Operation Warp Speed and come up with these vaccines. Billions in U.S. government money went to that. Emily, does it make a difference? Who should get the credit?
I'm sure it makes a difference to them. The Trump administration does deserve credit for Operation Warp Speed in that it allowed these pharmaceutical companies to manufacture to scale, which in normal times they would not have done. So that the vaccine is going to be available to as many people as it is, as soon as it is to the Trump administration's credit. That being said, the Trump administration has, I mean, I don't consider this to be a partisan statement, has badly mishandled this pandemic, denied for months that it was a problem, encouraged people to disobey their state's stay-at-home orders. So while they can take credit for the manufacturing or for the production of the vaccine, they can get credit for how this pandemic has gone, is how I'll put it.
Some of the policy people at the White House say that they always had to think about the economy. So the so-called shutdowns in various states were so bad for the economy that that affected people's health. And well, that's the reason that they suggested the balance they did. In general, Republicans were against, quote, shutdowns of schools and businesses. And Democrats felt that those shutdowns were necessary. In general, it became partisan. I'm also thinking about the World Health Organization, part of the UN, which reports it does not have enough money to make sure that developing countries get enough vaccines and medicines to fight COVID all around the world. The rich will benefit from vaccines before the poor do. Perhaps that is the way of the world. It reminds us that under President Trump, the U.S. this year left the World Health Organization, saying it's dominated too much by China, and supposedly the WHO was covering up the start of this coronavirus in China around 1 year ago. Tom, do you expect the Biden administration will rejoin the WHO as well as the Paris Climate Change Accord and perhaps other multinational deals, such as trying to negotiate a new version of the Iran nuclear accord that President Trump walked away from? This new era could affect health, international relations, and so much more.
Yes, Dan, absolutely on all three of the items you just mentioned. Biden, his aides have said they are going to rejoin the Paris Accords on the environment. They are going to resume membership in the World Health Organization and will contribute the money that the Trump administration cut off to the WHO. They're going to do that, and I suspect they will do that, some of that on day one or day two of the Biden administration. So all those things will be a quick reversal. The president doesn't require legislation to allow him to do that. He can sign an executive order and make those policy changes with the stroke of a pen, just as President Trump, with the stroke of his pen, changed a lot of policy immediately in January of 2017. So I think that's going to be a change. It'll be controversial, but I think most people generically will support a lot of that, but not all. Not all of Americans will support it. This is still a very polarized country.
Thank you, and happy holidays to all our listeners and to our panelists, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to The National Journal. This program is produced here in Washington by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravitz.